In our Dhamma talk tonight, we shall reconnect to the five controlling faculties, the Panch Indriyani in the Pali scriptural language, and we shall discuss in particular some ways of sharpening the controlling faculties. There are altogether nine such ways mentioned in the Visuddhimagga, and out of those nine ways, we will most likely deal with the first three. And the Visuddhimagga's explanations on those on sharpening the controlling faculties appear in the 20th chapter of the Visuddhimagga, namely the chapter that deals with the purification of what is the path and the not path. And there it says, it could happen that even though a meditator is having those five controlling faculties, and yet they are not effective, and they're not leading necessarily to the result of the arising of intuitive wisdom. So in that case, and then those nine ways of sharpening the controlling faculties is being recommended. Now, the relevant passage from the Visuddhimagga is as follows, and I'll quote the translation as given by Venerable Bhikkhu Jnanamoli. While thus engaged in inductive insight, however, if it does not succeed, one should sharpen one's faculties of faith, of effort, of mindfulness, of concentration, and of wisdom. In the nine ways stated thus, the faculties become sharp in nine ways. Number one, one sees only the destruction of arisen formations. Number two, and in that occupation of seeing only the destruction of arisen formations, one makes sure of working carefully. And number three, one makes sure of working perseveringly. That's number three. Number four is one makes sure of working suitably. And number five, by apprehending the sign of concentration. And number six, by balancing the enlightenment factors. Number seven, one establishes disregard of body and life. Number eight, wherein one overcomes pain by renunciation, and number nine, by not stopping halfway. So these are your nine ways in terms of just the headings. Now, those controlling faculties, as we have seen already in one of the earlier Dhamma talks, may help us tremendously to cut through multiple strata of delusion, and then hopefully lead to the arising of intuitive knowledge or wisdom. And as we have seen in one of the preceding talks, when wisdom arises in one stream of consciousness, then it will be accompanied by wholesome mental states. And this in turn will contribute to a meditator's experience of happiness. Now, the first one of the nine ways of control of sharpening the controlling faculties is that of paying or seeing only the destruction of arisen formations. In broader sense, that we could say is that this is paying attention to impermanence. Now, for a meditator who has as yet not yet directly seen impermanence, it's it might be helpful to take impermanence or to accept impermanence based on faith, on good faith, and assuming that formations will not be permanent, and then working based on this sutta assumption. This sutta will help a meditator to then maybe have less difficulties in the practice, and sutta then waste less sutta time, wrongly assuming that formations are permanent. Now, if one strongly believes that certain formations are permanent, compact, then this may block a meditator's practice. Now, this doesn't really apply to our group of meditators here, since all of you have already a direct understanding, gained some form of a direct understanding of impermanence. Now, when it comes to impermanence or the understanding of it, there are different levels of understanding impermanence or different aspects. When a meditator usually reaches the third insight knowledge, the knowledge by comprehension, samasana jnana in the Pali scriptural language, then one will typically see how a formation, a physical or mental formation, will arise, and then one will see the formation lasting for a while, possibly undergoing changes, and then one will also see how that same formation will subside. So one sees the arising, the lasting, the passing of a formation. Now, with this, it is already pretty obvious that formations are not permanent, because they keep changing. Now, the fact of impermanence will be further understood in a deeper way when one's practice moves on, and one then sees in a very direct, intuitive manner how formations in a rapid manner appear, disappear. They arise, they pass away. And so when one sees that, no doubt formations are not permanent, but rather impermanent. Now, the understanding of impermanence, anicca, is said to be reached in meditators who then gain another knowledge of another intuitive knowledge, and that is the knowledge of seeing formations as passing away. So, if that is the case, and one sees not just one, but plenty of formations passing away, then fact of impermanence gets pretty well established in the stream of consciousness. Now, Pali version of what has been read out early on in English from the Visuddhimagga on the first way of sharpening the controlling faculties reads as follows, namely, upanupananam sankharanam kayam eva pasati. Upana is the past participle of upajati, meaning arisen or reborn. Sankhara are your conditioned phenomena, and then kaya is a masculine noun meaning disintegration or destruction or cessation or breaking up or decay. Eva is an emphatic particle, and pasati means he or she sees. So if we follow the Pali, then literally, then it means one sees only the destruction of arisen formations. And please notice that certainly it says here destruction of arisen formations. So formations that are there, that have already arisen. However, the emphasis being on the destruction, seeing the destruction. Now, this certain particular explanation from the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, is more specific than saying to pay attention to impermanence. It's the height of impermanence or the peak of impermanence that one is asked to pay attention to. Now, when it comes to impermanence, there are so many different aspects that have to do with impermanence. And are there any that you are familiar with, that you have noticed so far? Formations are what? Formations are impermanent. And other aspects of impermanence would be?
Changeable.
Yes, this is correct.
Unsatisfactory.
That has more to do with the second universal characteristic of dukkha. I know. By extension, yes. But the aspect of impermanence itself. So, other aspects of impermanence that you have noticed so far in your practice?
Unstable,
there you go. Correct. And subject to what?
Destruction.
Subject to destruction, yes. Also subject to death. And subject to arising, and subject to annihilation, and they're unenduring, perishable, fickle, disintegrating, etc. So there's a whole list of 10 different aspects of impermanence being mentioned in the text. Again, this is from the Patthisamvita Magga.
Did you say fickle?
What's that?
Did you say fickle?
Yes. Like the weather is fickle. The weather is fickle, it means certainly the weather is changeable. Likewise, physical and mental formations are what? Enduring or changeable? Well, they change all the time. If you observe really carefully, then you will see it directly. Now, to proceed in our exploration of this aspect of impermanence, and in particular the aspect of the ending of formations being subject to destruction. Now, we have all noticed how during rainfall, a raindrop falls onto the ground, and suddenly then, if this happens many times, then a puddle forms, and then if another raindrop falls onto this puddle, then the raindrop will burst. Or even if it falls on the soil like this, it will also burst. And so as soon, or if we take the case of a soap bubble, so like children do, they play with these things, they cause a soap bubble to appear, and then within maybe at the most 5-10 seconds or so, the soap bubble will then pop. Now, we may also see the destruction of formations in nature in the case of lightning. When lightning strikes, then usually it happens so quickly that the beginning of the lightning is not so obvious, whereas the ending of it is relatively obvious. And so then, in the case of preparing popcorn, we might in a pan or a pot, we may then hear one corn after another bursting. Or in the case of a bomb exploding, this will happen in a particular manner, namely all of a sudden and probably quite violently. Then another worldly example or illustration for destruction would be in the case of fireworks. So when shooting or playing with fireworks, then there will be an explosion, and or maybe even many explosions in the sky, and then that many colors suddenly will be seen there. Now, here in New Mexico, we have plenty of adobe buildings. If you do not maintain an adobe building for an extended period of time, then what will happen?
It will dissolve
into mud, and at least if other materials, building construction materials, have not been used. So if we take an original adobe building, as for instance in the Pueblo here in Taos, if it's not properly maintained, then sooner or later grasses will start growing on its top, and then heavy rain will then soften the walls, and then cracks may form, and eventually the walls might come tumbling down. So then you'll have a gradual destruction. Now, another example would certainly be that of pouring dye or some watercolors into a glass of water. And so there's a very particular way how those dyes or the watercolors then mix with water. So it's a gradual process. It doesn't happen all of a sudden. And certainly then, if you think of, let's say, a car. So let's say you've had a car accident and you're happy to get away from the accident site, so you just leave your car behind, and then your car remains there for a month, for 2 months, and very soon people will realize, this seems like an abandoned car. And then under the assumption that it doesn't belong to anyone, what will happen? People will strip it, there you go, and they will help themselves maybe a new pair or new set of tires. They might help themselves to a new hood, they might help themselves to a new steering wheel and whatever is precious, or maybe even the engine, which might be the most important part. And so whatever is still in a relatively good condition will be stripped from that car. And eventually, the owner will be left with maybe just the chassis, and that's all. So a gradual process of destruction. Now, does this have anything to do with our meditation practice? I mean, destruction.
You better.
You are quite correct. So, these illustrations have much to do with our meditation practice, because formations are not only arising, but one of their key features is that they also end, disintegrate, and then break up, cease, fade away, etc., etc. Now, in the course of the meditation practice, if this kind of thing happens to be the main feature of your meditation, then you might as well pay attention to it, rather than just giving only preference to the beginning, as most people, beginning of objects, as most people are doing. Now, when the ending, the destruction, the disintegration of objects naturally happens to be the most predominant aspect in your meditation practice, then you might want to check very carefully how this is happening. And you might check very carefully, is there any change? Are there any changes with regard to your the labeling itself? What about the body as a whole? We have this notion of a body being one solid entity with clear-cut boundaries, etc. And is this the case or not? And then you might investigate some very basic facts, whether objects can be clearly located or not. And you might then also want to find out how objects are vanishing. And then you might also want to pay attention to the speed with which this ending or disintegration of formations is happening. So, is this happening at a really slow speed or pace, or is this maybe happening quite quickly or extremely quickly? And does the ending, the disintegration of formations concern only the rising falling movement of the abdomen, or does it also concern, let's say, seeing impressions, hearing impressions, smelling impressions, etc.? Does it concern only material phenomena, or maybe also mental phenomena? So there's much that certainly could be explored. And then what about, let's say, mental formations? Do they seem all that, are they really all that compact as they first appear upon superficial observation? Now, as we have seen in with the illustrations or examples given earlier on from the worldly sphere, the disintegration of an object, the ending of an object, may happen in many different ways. There is no standard way how this happens. And so, maybe to give one more pretty obvious example, day after day, the sun is setting. And so, is the sun always setting in the same way, one standard way? One way, or a certain very particular way of the setting of the sun. There is no such standard way. And sometimes when the weather conditions are favorable, then we might be seeing a huge red ball there gradually setting and can be quite impressive. On other days, if it's foggy, then the setting of the sun might not be, might be half foggy, half clear. And then if it's raining, it might be again quite a different experience. And certain, and then sometimes there might certainly even be, other, or let's say if it's raining and then there's even a thunderstorm, then it might be even more impressive. So, likewise, there are objects, physical as well as mental objects, in our meditation practice tend to disintegrate in different ways. Now, the Visuddhimagga clearly speaks of destruction. Kaya is certainly the Pali scriptural term for this, which means destruction. The term is spelled Khaya, and not to be confused with the word Gaya, which means body. And so, in the case of this seeing the destruction of formations, this is said to help abandon the perception of compactness. And perception of compactness may be of different kinds. Now, one does not right away see this sudden destruction of certain formations or engage in the respective contemplation of certain destruction. This happens only when the dissolution of formations has become quite certain familiar. Now, one case of the destruction of the compact would be in terms of seeing the destruction of compactness as a continuity. Now, already several times we have said that the rising movement and falling movement of the abdomen at first observation may seem to be a rather continuous movement. Upon closer observation, one might find it's not a continuous movement, but more a wave-like movement. Then, upon even closer observation, one might find that it is a segmented movement, so a movement that consists of several segments. If one observes even more carefully, one might sooner or later find that same rising movement or falling movement breaks down further and then consists of just a series of dots. So that would be a case for seeing the destruction of compactness as a continuity. Now, there is a second case, namely compactness as a mass. And this in the Pali scripture language is given as samuhana gana. And so what this means is that we might be observing a mass of hardness, and so it seems pretty solid, pretty compact, and upon closer observation we find that this mass of hardness isn't really one solid object, but rather consists of many hundreds if not thousands of points of hardness. So if we see that, then it amounts to the destruction of the compactness of hardness, or compactness as a mass. Now, there is yet a third type of compactness, namely as function, and this too on occasion might be seen as breaking apart, falling apart. And so for the most part, the various insight knowledges fulfill a very specific function. And since this happens again and again, one then, or it becomes even predictable, and one may assume, okay, next thing in the practice will be so and so. However, that compactness as a function, kichagana, in the Pali scripture language, at times itself may break up, and then at a particular stage in our practice, things then are somewhat chaotic and very much different from our expectations. So this then we could refer to as the destruction of compactness as a function. And then the last example is that of aramana gana, compactness as an object. And here too, when one takes an object such as a pain, one sees the entire thing and then closely focuses on it, then one might see how that pain then breaks up into thousands of particles. And then one can either that or a formation or an object, a sensation, no longer qualifies as qualifies for what it had earlier been seen. So maybe at first one experiences a certain sensation and one clearly says, okay, this is a pain, but then later on the object falls apart hard, and that it loses its boundary, it loses its specific qualities, and then one can no longer call it a clear-cut pain. So that would be a case for destruction of compactness as an object. Now, these four forms, or some of these forms of seeing the destruction of compactness, might be seen in the fourth or the fifth insight knowledge. Now, when a meditator takes to heart the observation of, in general, the dissolution of formations, or even more specifically, the destruction of formations, then he or she might be seeing plenty of fascinating details. And so then, if at first this observation was somewhat boring, then later on one can't get enough of seeing it. And so one is basically waiting for the next object to be there, to take a close look at it, and to see once again how this next object is going to disappear. Now, if that stage is reached, then obviously your mindfulness will be much sharper, and observing really carefully requires more effort, so your level of effort will have gone up, and then also your concentration will be stronger, obviously wisdom will deepen, and based on this your faith in the practice will also deepen further. So having clearly seen how objects disappear in different ways, this then will help to build your faith. So in this way we can say that we can find that indeed paying attention to the destruction of arisen formations and is a way of sharpening the five controlling faculties. So this is one aspect. Now, the second way to sharpen the controlling faculties is given as in the Pali scriptural language as tatta cha sakaccha kriyaya sampadeti, which then means, according to Bhikkhu Nyanamuli, and in that occupation, namely of paying attention to the destruction of formations, one makes sure of working carefully. Now, the Venerable Sadhu Pandita Nibbams of Burma has referred to this particular aspect as care and respect, practicing with care and respect, which then is certainly indeed a very important aspect. Now, when we come to Vipassana retreat for the very first time, then and we've never done a retreat certainly before, we've lived our life in a rather rather casual manner, then most likely we will not take this practice too seriously, and we will do this practice in a casual, easygoing way, in a relaxed way, in certain kind of in a playful way. Should one be so serious about the whole thing? However, Vipassana practice is different from other activities. And we could say that Vipassana practice is not just, a hobby or so, or something that you waste your time on, rather like an art. So if you set your goal on becoming a world famous violin player, then will you approach your playing and practicing the violin in a casual manner? Most likely not. So most likely this will be important to you, and then you will give the practice much care and respect. So when we practice, we want to we want to do so with utmost reverence and meticulousness. And a word that I have found to be quite helpful in this context lately is that of devotion. So when we practice, we want to devote ourselves wholeheartedly to the observation of whatever predominant object comes along, even the most negligible object. So an activity such as opening and closing a door, what about this? It's such an ordinary activity. Why should I pay attention to this? That would be an ordinary way of reasoning. However, even in this, there is a potential for realizing the Dhamma. Now, when we reflect on, when we know and reflect on the seven classical benefits that are being ascribed to the Satipatthana practice, and then quite naturally we will want to do it with reverence and meticulousness and with devotion, and those benefits being purification of the mind or of beings, and overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, total destruction of physical pain and mental distress, and entering into the right path, and finally the attainment of Nibbana. Now the Visuddhimagga says that there are hundreds of benefits that can be attributed to the realization of Nibbana. Or realization of the path of stream entry. And so we are thus engaging in a practice that's in a gradual way, in a gradual, gentle way, will bring about profound and positive changes into our, or in our life. So this being so, we might as well then treat our own practice properly. And what this then means is that we practice, that we slow down all of our movements as much as we can, and we perform each and every activity during the general activities, and then the walking meditation itself, and then sitting down in the sitting meditation, sitting itself, getting up from a sitting, etc. We do everything as mindfully as we possibly could. Now, the Buddha has, in this connection, has suddenly given a wonderful illustration for how one could practice. And allow me to quote from the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, the translation, the Samyutta Nikaya, translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. It appears that such a group of monks were not practicing properly, and the Buddha then addressed them. But I'll start at the beginning. The title of the discourse is "The Most Beautiful Girl of the Land." This discourse can be found in the 47th Samyutta, the Satipatthana Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. "Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living among the Sumbas, where there was a town of the Sumbas named Sedaka. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus," bhikkhus. "Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, suppose that on hearing the most beautiful girl of the land, a great crowd of people would assemble. Now, that most beautiful girl of the land would dance exquisitely and sing exquisitely. On hearing the most beautiful girl of the land is dancing, the most beautiful girl of the land is singing, an even larger crowd wishing to, an even larger crowd of people would assemble. Then a man would come along, wishing to live, not wishing to die, wishing for happiness, averse to suffering. Someone would say to him, 'Good man, you must carry around this bowl of oil filled to the brim between the crowd and the most beautiful girl of the land. A man with a drawn sword will be following right behind you, and wherever you spill even a little of the oil, right there he will fell your head.'" So, what do you think? The bhikkhus, would that man stop attending to that bowl of oil and out of negligence turn his attention outwards? So, look at the crowd, or look at the most beautiful girl dancing and singing. And the bhikkhus obviously say, what? Yes or no? They say no. And then the Buddha goes on to conclude, and he says, "I have made up this simile," so it's just for teaching purposes, "in order to convey a meaning. This here is the meaning. The bowl of oil filled to the brim. This is a designation for mindfulness directed to the body." So the body can be seen as a pot filled with oil, and certainly we need to keep our attention on it. Otherwise, certainly we'll be in big trouble. "Therefore, because you should train yourselves thus, we will develop and cultivate mindfulness directed to the body. Make it our vehicle, make it our basis, stabilize it, exercise ourselves in it, and fully perfect it. Thus, bhikkhus, and by extension, bhikkhunis and lay meditators, should you train yourselves." So, this is a beautiful simile, and there's further meaning to it. Namely, when you keep your attention on the body and you practice kaya nupasana satipatthana, mindful contemplation of the body, then the automatic consequence of this is that you will also be practicing restraint of the senses, because you'll be so busy working or observing objects occurring in the body that you don't have any time, or you don't have the time to look at external objects. Just like the man who was carrying that bowl or that pot full of oil. So he had to be totally attentive to the pot on his head, otherwise, and had no time whatsoever to look at that beautiful, most beautiful girl dancing and singing exquisitely. Now, the simile of Barefoot, the man carrying a bowl full of oil on his head might be interpreted in yet another way, and certain Venerable Analaya proposes that it is an illustration for centeredness. So just like the man who was carrying this certain bowl of oil had to walk very strained, so too in our meditation practice we have to be centered. So this sudden simile might be very useful to remember in the context of practicing with great care and respect. Now, another example would be that of crossing a narrow footbridge with no railing to hold on to, and underneath, well, a deep gorge, and then a river with a river carrying a huge amount of water flowing down there at great speed. And in a violent manner. So if one were to run across this narrow footbridge, then probably sooner or later one would slip and fall off the footbridge. So when crossing if one wants to cross the narrow footbridge properly, then one has to do so with all attention, paying full attention to each and every step, to one's body, one needs to ensure that the body is well centered, etc., etc. Now, in the meditation practice, there's a principle of the slower you do your general activities, the more progress there will be in your practice. And it's not that the faster you move around, the faster you will progress. Now, obviously, there are certain exceptions. Let's say when people are lining up at the buffet for breakfast or lunch, then we need to, take food, or we need to be considerate of others waiting in line, and then maybe speed up a little bit. Now, when it's other examples that could be given, that certain principle of practicing with care and respect is certain very important, let's say, for surgeons and certain dentists. So if you think of a brain surgeon, if a brain surgeon is inattentive just for a split second, then he may he or she might perform do great damage to the patient, and maybe irreparable damage. And the same thing goes for a dentist. If he or she is not really attentive to the work, then some damage will surely be done to the teeth. To share a personal story in this regard, during the early days in Lumbini, and so this is long time ago, 1998, in February 98. 98 or 99, during this first 2 years. Back then, the medical facilities in Lumbini and its surrounding area were pretty bad. And especially in terms of dentists. And there was no dentist in Lumbini, there was no dentist in the nearest town in Bainwa. The next dentist was supposed to be in Butwal, so 40 kilometers away. It so happened that I ended up with a bad tooth and really had to see a dentist, and unaware of the situation, the medical situation in or health medical health situation in the region. So I asked around and some local people recommended, oh well, there's this wonderful dentist in Butwal, will be happy to introduce you to that dentist. So happily I went there with a smile on my face, but soon the smiling stopped. And so, and then we walk into this small dentist dental clinic, and maybe half of it was already occupied by the waiting room, and the other half, so the whole thing was already pretty small, and so half of it was just for a waiting room, and the other half was the actual the clinic. And then the equipment seemed already pretty worn out, maybe just slightly post World War II, with already a little bit of discomfort, I sat down on the dentist chair, and then explained to the dentist what the problem was, and literally physically showed him which tooth was problematic. So he said, "No problem, no problem." And you can imagine what happened. And so he prepares his drill and then sets to work and starts drilling on the wrong tooth, on a good tooth. My goodness, I said, enough of this, and I left the dental clinic. So once and never again. So, if a dentist doesn't practice with or work with care and respect, the patients have to suffer. Now, another negative example would be in certain places. When you get invited, and let's say as a group, and then the food gets served, then it may happen, especially when serving the soup and let's say some liquidish type of dishes, curries, that half of it ends up on your lap. Oh, what a pleasure. And so, that would be another case of, serving food, but certainly in a rather inattentive manner. Or, I've seen cases of people eating, and the end result was after the meal a big mess around the place where the person was eating. So again, a case of no care and respect. Now, this much in terms of the second way of sharpening the controlling faculties, and the third one is certainly in terms of unbroken continuity, sata chakiriya sampadeti in the Pali scriptural language, literally or as translated by Venerable Jnana Bodhi, this means one makes sure of working perseveringly. So, despite of discouragement, opposition, or previous failure, one simply continues with one's meditation practice. Now, part of or aspects that are valid under this certain heading is that certain one tries certain to do well one tries to do one works on the continuity of one's mindfulness in general, and in particular one tries to do one thing at a time. When changing postures, one will try to break down the movements into single units and then be mindful of each and every of those units with utmost care. And then one will also want to pay attention to details such as opening, closing of the eyes, a detail that most meditators don't pay attention to. And then one might also, when observing predominant objects, do so without getting lost in unnecessary reflections and thinking, reasoning, etc. So as soon as an object has arisen, then one wants to be with the object, one wants to be with it continuously, moment after moment. One moment of mindfulness connecting to the next moment of mindfulness. Now, during the early stages of one's mindfulness practice, it is a teacher's job to remind a meditator to be continuously mindful, and then gradually meditators are getting the point, and later on a meditator will naturally see or naturally understand that the continuity of mindfulness is certainly important and will pay attention to it. Now, even later on in the practice, when formations become pretty refined, the observing and knowing mind is also quite refined, then the continuity of mindfulness becomes even more important. So when we practice, we want we want to persevere when it comes to the continuity of mindfulness, and not give in, not go for some excuse or with an excuse throw in the towel and then maybe rest in the room. So we do not want to be like chameleons who have a habit of moving ahead for a little while and then all of a sudden stopping and then gazing around. One doesn't quite know what they're doing, and then all of a sudden dashing forward again. So chameleons manage to survive in this way, but meditators may not if their mindfulness is somewhat intermittent and of an on and off nature. Let me conclude today's Satna Dhamma talk by wishing may those first three ways of sharpening the controlling faculties be helpful, and may they help to indeed sharpen the faculties, and then may this in turn contribute to a cutting through our many layers of delusion. With this may more and more wisdom arise, and ultimately may it culminate in the wisdom of liberation, of gaining liberation from suffering through first of all through the attainment of the noble path of stream entry. And may this happen during this very retreat here and in Taos. And this is it for now.
time for questions?
Okay, let's hear briefly.
You speak about unbroken continuity of mindfulness, and then you also speak about moments of mindfulness. So the part you refer to is from moment to moment to moment.
Yes, indeed.
What is this moment of mindfulness that you're referring to? What is a moment as opposed to continuity of mindfulness?
Well, now there's many moments of mindfulness which make up a continuity of mindfulness.
Yeah, but what is this moment?
Moment, it means that that the mental, for that moment, the mental factor of mindfulness is present. Rather than some other mental factor, rather than absent-mindedness, negligence. And with this,
trying to find it in my experience, what you're referring to is a moment of mindfulness. That's mindfulness, period.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, you can define the term moment. You can define as defined in the Abhidhamma by Kana. Kana, the Pali term Kana is one moment, which is extremely short. I don't know, there's probably billions of moments of moments too, within one snap of fingers or one blinking of the eyes. So does this satisfy you?
Yeah, that's
a similar degree. So with that at least you know what a moment is. Yes, Lan.
And go to the inside faster than the...
What's that?
The moment, mindfulness will lead to the moment concentration. We have three types of concentration. So if the mindfulness is carefully in which moment, lead to the moment concentration?
Well, when your mindfulness is quite certain and continuous, then sooner or later the mind will be or land squarely on the object of observation, and certain with this thing concentration is there, and it will be there from moment to moment if the mindfulness continues to be continues to be continuous.
Concentration will get to the inside faster than the other type concentration.
And when then mindfulness is present, and mindfulness present, concentration is also present, and we assume that effort is also there, and faith is also there. Then out of this intuitive wisdom that will arise. Does this answer your question? Yes?